Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I am here with Kevin. Kevin, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Nick.
Yeah, I've been excited to get you on, man. You're a, as I was saying, you're like a kindred spirit to me. I think we kind of look at the world the same way, and we see a lot of the untapped potential for compliance to have on the, you know, strategic direction of an organization. So I was excited to get you on to kind of pick your brain and let our listeners learn some more about you and some of your perspective, because I think it's real powerful.
Thank you. It's great to be on as well. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So let's just jump in. Why don't you kind of tell us your story? You know, everybody thinks they have a really unique story of how they got into compliance, because nobody wants to be a compliance officer when they're nine. But the commonality is that everyone's path in is super unique. So how did you kind of get to where you are today?
Well, I'm on a around the world journey, I feel. Obviously, I'm from the UK, but living in Detroit now. And I've been in my current role as a lawyer. I've been in my current company and sort of progressed through the company for 10 years. And I guess throughout that 10 years, I was involved in compliance related work as the legal department. We sort of had part ownership in that, in developing a code of business conduct. This was, you know, when I first joined this company in 2010, the UK Bribery Act came out, and that actually came out just a couple of months after I joined. So it's something I got involved in straight away. And, you know, following that sort of made a lot of people think. I think that was a turning point in compliance, was, hold on, this is a really draconian law here. Maybe we should look at stuff, you know, and on the back of the financial crisis, I guess. So then, you know, you do that, and then it sort of gets in this rhythm of, we've rolled out a code of business conduct, we've rolled out training, we do investigations, and we get in this repeated cycle. And then I guess I actually found a lot of struggle in that personally. When we're doing these investigations, it was for small fry and people lose their jobs. And it's like, why are we have these rules? Why can't people follow them? I'm a lawyer. If I'm told to do something, you just do it. but people, these are written down. Everybody says, yeah, we agree to it. And they don't. I don't get it. And it's so I started thinking about that. And then we had a bigger claim in sort of 2017, which came in, which I didn't want to investigate at first. It would be part of it. It's like, oh, this doesn't seem real. And it involved, you know, people I think were friends who were implicated. And it's like, I've worked with these people for years. This was, you know, some of this is under my watch when I was in Asia. Like, I don't know. And then I had to fly out, and it was my wife's birthday. We'd just moved to the States. Didn't go down too well, but, you know, you got to do it. But I remember saying to her, actually, I think this could make me, I feel like there's something going to come out of this. And it was, because I went there, we investigated. There were some issues that I thought we need to address. And so I brought that back, and we had lots of conversations at the very senior level of the company, decided to actually do a deep dive investigation. We did that. I went out there, spent some time in Asia, more time in Asia, which meant more time away from my family that was just moved to the US. But after that, it was, I don't know how we got to this stage in our company where we have all of these rules. And then it's, we say, we can, you know, blame these people who were caught up in it, but actually, what did we do as management? What did we do? Like, yeah, we had a code of business conduct. We did this training, but maybe that's where, and we thought that was enough. That ticked the box. Maybe it's not enough. Maybe we need to look at, stop going with the do the right thing, otherwise people go to jail message, which I think is, that was there probably at the beginning of sort of 2010, you know, and essentially, I guess, from Enron and Sarbanes-Oxley coming in, and, you know, it's just like, tell people that people are going to go to jail if they don't do the right thing, because that is what happens.
Right.
Yeah. But for the everyday person in our offices and our factories, that doesn't resonate with them. Oh, this is small. Nobody's ever going to find out type of thing. It's like, why? So it's more about flipping it. You know, as Simon Sinek says, start with a why.
Yeah.
So I got the opportunity, I guess, to off my own back, start looking at that and, well, do we have a compliance program in our company? We have these things. Yeah, you can call it a compliance program, but what are other companies doing? It's like, look outside. And then it's just, then you start reading these things. And now I'm like reading books on behavioral science and neuroeconomics, and because these all play into what I've realized what it comes down to is something is purpose and culture. These are the big things. And I think I remember you said something about how in the future, this is the age of the chief compliance officer or chief ethics and compliance officer.
Right.
Chief happiness officer, you know, there's going to be a shift in the way people think, and that's reflected in the demographic that is working today, the growing demographic as it is. The boomers are getting slowly phased out. Then I guess my generation are going through, and we've probably got another 10, 15 years, but then it's millennials or whatever you want to call them. This generation is already coming into leadership positions and growing. And I think, there's a much more focus on purpose and culture, and compliance is at the heart of that.
Yeah. we always talk about compliance is culture. And I couldn't agree more. This sort of culture piece, this, which is really kind of a trust piece at a certain level. Like think about, you know, any strong culture you've been a part of there, it's whether it's a team, it's a sports team, it's a family, it's a group of friends. There's a certain glue of trust there. And then on the other side of the fence is this purpose thing, this why, this sort of intangible driving force or this pursuit of something bigger than ourselves. I think the marriage of those two things are really powerful if we can get it right. But it's an interesting path that you just kind of described. And I think it's a metaphor for or a picture of this broader path that compliance in general is on over the last, you know, three decades, right? It's similar to the path that maybe HR was on. And it sort of starts as this compulsory thing, or it starts as this this you know group of activities that are in response to some kind of a regulation or some kind of a pronouncement or something that we need to do to tighten it up, right? It's sort of reactive or reactionary. And then at some point, the light bulbs start to turn on to say, oh, this is bigger than a kind of a check the box thing. It actually indirectly or maybe directly sort of influences some of these other factors and dynamics that are actual sort of primary ingredients in the pursuit of our mission. So it's just interesting as you talked about that, where it was like, hey, I kind of got into this game because, you know, this UK Bribery Act came out. And then as we started to kind of build these things out, we see this flip occurring where we need to motivate people not to not do the wrong thing, but instead motivate them to do the right thing. And that can only come kind of organically.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely now an absolute overlap between ethics. I like to call it ethics and compliance because I think compliance really is tick the box. Are you following the law? Are you following our policies? Yes, no. There really isn't a gray area in that. Ethics, there is. Yeah. So you are following the law or you are following our policies. Great. But also, are your decisions the right decisions to make? For instance, like, you know, terminating people. So, you know, let's go right now to COVID-19 and, you know, furlough schemes. And there's so many stories now coming out about the companies who take the furlough money or take the government support, then lay off staff. And I was having a conversation with a friend in the UK the other day who was saying, one of the big issues is, companies taking the money and using that money to then lay off the people. I mean,
right.
Legally, you can do it. You broken the law? No. Is it the right thing to do? Absolutely not. And I think it's getting that, you know, if you look at ethics and as a Venn diagram within one circle and compliance or in line with the laws and policies in another circle, and you push them together and it's that intersection in between, that's our space.
Right.
That's the space that we own as ethics and compliance officers. And that's the space that we want our people that we work with to play in. And it's trying to how to get them because questions or I often get is Kevin, but it's legal, right? It's not illegal. No. Is it in breach of our policies? No. So what's the big deal? It's like, because, you know, we're a public company. Think about our image. You know, think about what this message sends to the people who work in this organization. And we need people, you know, my company is a lean company. We want our people to be engaged and motivated and I think it's hard. And I think we're at that stage, maybe it's still at the early stages of in the evolution of the function and the role ethics and compliance plays is that it actually plays a role across the entire organization.
Right.
And it's actually educate. I think we are in the education stage at the moment of really educating all of our colleagues, the business and the leaders, managers and the staff and other employees that, you know, this is part and parcel of the way we do work. It's like breathing. You don't think about it, you just do it.
Right. But it's funny that, I don't know, it's such like a mentality thing, right? Like, are you trying to hit the letter of the law or the letter of the policy, or are you trying to hit the spirit of the law and the spirit of the policy? And yeah. Do you view that policy on the one hand as etched in stone and we have a policy, so we're good to go? Or do you view that as, hey, this is a Word document, or this is really kind of written in pencil, and we can't just assume that this policy is going to be comprehensive ad infinitum, right? It's going to, circumstances change, you know, generations change, people change, whatever changes. So those policies need to be malleable, to your point, to make sure that they're driving the behaviors and drawing those lines around the field in the places that they actually need to be, you know?
Yeah. And I think the old Kevin of 2010 and sort of getting into compliance and dealing with it is like, oh, tick the box. You know, we've got a defense here. We've done everything, tick the box. Our policies work. It's hard and fast rule. It's very easy to then go, we didn't follow the policy, so that's our hook. Whereas now I'm much more, I think it's actually a mix. But the underlying is, what is the spirit of the policy? What are we trying to get? Because, you know, everybody, and by using that definition or that approach, it's much harder for people to say, yeah, I did this, or, you know, I didn't do that, and try and find a way out, because that's what people look for.
Exactly.
Is, what's my way out, you know? And I think, well, you know, it's not in the spirit of the, you know, what the intention of this policy is. It's to do this, this, or this.
Right.
And, you know, even though you did do this, and technically it doesn't fall, or it's not captured in the policy, or it doesn't, there's no specific wording in the policy to deal with it, you know, that's not in the spirit of the policy.
Exactly. And I think people with this old kind of check the box thinking, they just need some tires on the car, right? You can put some bald tires on the car that have no tread on them, and you can drive down the road, but you can't drive that fast. You can't go around a curve quickly. You can't drive in the rain. And I think if they can acclimate more toward the getting the right tires on the car, which is kind of akin to, you know, the spirit of the law, quote unquote, type of an approach, well, now you get better performance. And it's not just about having, you know, I don't really care what tires are on the car. I want the best tires for what I'm trying to do. And what's interesting about this thing, this tipping point that I feel like we're getting close to, is that not only do I think it's going to separate organizations, but I think the ones who are on the right side of history, so to speak, are going to be the ones who realize that there's a real strategic role that this function can play, and I need to unleash it. Like, I got this hot rod here. I got this race car that I'm not getting the performance out of it because the tires are not gripping the road at the rate that I'm trying to drive it down the road. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I was thinking about something I posted on LinkedIn the other day, which was about, you really need to worry when your best people start being quiet.
Yes.
And your passionate people start being quiet. And I think ethics and compliance people are very passionate about what they do, because it isn't purely, as we're saying now, it isn't purely tick the box. It's understanding how that interplays in an entire organization, and it's part of the beating heart. It goes down straight down to the core values and how those resonate out, how those fit with the policies that the company comes up with or the organization comes up with, and how you breathe life into those policies, because a policy isn't just a piece of paper. It's something that lives and breathes in the way you operate, the way your behaviors of your people and what your expectations are. And I actually think companies need to utilize the energy that ethics and compliance people bring to the organization, because, you know, it's a lot of work. And ethics and compliance functions, with the best will of the world, tend to still be very small functions within organizations. You know, when you think about, they've got the work encompasses the entire span of the organization. And if you headcount wise, it's very, very small. Resource wise, very, very small. You're scrapping for money that is hard to always justify. But it's like an insurance. But then, you know, would you operate without your business insurance? No. You have to have business insurance. Just driving a car. I've never had an accident in 20 years of driving, but I still have to pay for insurance every year. You don't want to use it. And ethics and compliance is like that. The benefits you don't always see, except I think you are, because it companies with better ethics and compliance cultures, you tend to have more engagement, which therefore leads to productivity, which therefore hits your bottom line.
Yeah, it's the it's that classic sort of indirect relationship, which we see all the time throughout our body. Or, you know, like our body is this really complex machine, right? It's this complex organism, and there's all these indirect functions going on that end up influencing other things. And hey, why are you in a bad mood? Well, it's because you didn't have dinner last night, or because you didn't have sleep, or because you're stressed, right? Like, yeah, all those things kind of have these sort of chain reactions that lead to the end result or the symptom that we're kind of responding to. And I think the profitability of an organization is really the byproduct of how that machine is running and how those sort of those competing or those sort of harmonious disparate activities can sort of play off of each other. And, it, you know, I talk about this a lot because I'm just baffled by it. But we have these largely, right? I mean, again, you know, incompetence runs rampant, but like largely somebody running a large company, they're probably not a total fool, right? Like they're smart people. They probably went to a good school. They have some kind of skill level to allow them to ascend to that position. And yet when they get to that position, there's this sort of breakdown that occurs to where, well, if I can't see the direct impact of these dollars that I'm allocating to this function, then you know what? It's time to tighten the belt and you guys need to kind of make do with the crumbs that kind of dropped off the table.
Yeah.
What do you think that is? What is at the root of that light bulb that to me is, I mean, mine's on, yours is clearly on. This is a massive opportunity to get more performance out of the car, to use that previous analogy. What happens as somebody ascends to where that light bulb dims or it's not on and they don't see the opportunity that you and I see?
I think it comes down to one, we are much more short-termism. And if you look at the S&P 500, the FTSE 100, FTSE 250, look at the age of companies now, they're much younger companies and they don't hang around as long. You know, I'm a company that's going to be turning 100 soon. And it's about pressure. Like short-termism drives pressure. So it's like, where am I going to get where am I going to get the most bang for my buck? Well, the most bang for your buck is something that you see immediately. If it's way down the line where that bigger result comes, you can't see it. It's too far. And so you focus on the short-term gains. And that's what you're rewarded for. Like reward programs and compensation programs in companies are very short-term focused on annual goals or short-term deliverables. And so there's a pressure on leaders to do that, because now also there is, you know, people aren't scared to necessarily get rid of senior executives and board members and so forth. So people are, you know, when you're getting paid hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, to run and lead and perform, you know, you get used to that. I guess that's like being a junkie, right? You get used to your standard of living with that, your way your life is, and you want to maintain that. So you focus on these short-term gains to keep your own life cycle going. And so you forego some of the things which, you know, you can't sell compliance out publicly that as easily. You know, it's like you're going to investors, we've got this program and we're doing really well. We haven't got any claims. Yeah, but if you didn't spend that money, would you not have the same result? You know, they don't understand that. Whereas you can say, for R&D and things like that, you can go, well, we're inventing this, or, you know, in my space, electric vehicles and electrification and automation. Yeah, people sort of get excited by those ideas, but compliance and ethics that you don't get excited about. You don't get excited about doing the right thing, but you get excited about the new fad that's going to come in. And
yeah, that's an interesting thing you just kind of brought up, right? Like, the intangibility of it almost kind of works against it, coupled with its indirect impact and influence. Like, it obviously creates, you know, if you're firing on all cylinders in your ethics and compliance function, it creates the type of environment that allows for people to truly engage and so forth. But it's, to your point, three steps away. You're not going to get that sort of margin pop or that, you know, stock price pop that's going to keep those analysts on last quarter's call happy and saying, wow, these guys really performed to the thing, right?
Yeah.
And yet we just seem to get, I don't know, it's just, I feel like on a micro level, on a person to person level, you know that, you know, I can just do a crash diet and lose some weight. That doesn't mean that I'm actually healthy. And to be healthy, I have to change my lifestyle. And I know that over the long run, if I'm jogging every day and I'm cutting out the junk food or whatever, then I'm going to have a longer life, right? Like, we get that on our individual basis. But it's like, again, there's this like this thing that breaks down when we're talking about something that's arguably more complex than the human body. It's a bunch of human bodies coming, you know, to a series of sort of related locations in pursuit of some organization's, you know, agreed upon mission or goal. There, it just kind of devolves down to this very base, very basic, oh, what's the new shiny object that you're going after, and where's my money?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the one positive thing that we're starting to see, and you know what, I think it comes through recognition of the demographic that is coming through. We talked about, you know, who are becoming leaders, who are the workforce today, is that purpose of a company is coming more to the forefront, and which is why we have a growing move towards ESG requirements and corporate social responsibility, which all, you know, ethics and compliance even touches that, because, you know, these purposes, that to be genuinely build a culture and a culture of compliance, it has to start from the root, the core, and that's your core values and your purpose and your mission. You have to align those. And then you need, it's not just setting them, it's delivering those consistently. It can't be, you can have posters of your core values everywhere in the world, but unless you talk about it, you reinstate those on a daily basis, and not just the tone, the leader who must be doing it on a daily basis to his team. It's got to filter all the way to the, you know, to the lowest paid employee, to even to like the casual laborers. They need to come in and go and understand what those are and the role they play in supporting those values. And it's from that, then you build out, and you've got to build trust and psychological safety, you know, all of the things that are positive. And to get your innovation, even if, you know, we're going to develop the next interactive entertainment system in cars, or, you know, because people aren't going to be driving anymore, it's going to be autonomous, so people need entertainment there. We're going to develop that. Well, nobody's going to come out with the ideas if they don't feel safe enough to speak up. You know, I'm trying to say, in my role at work now, it's like we launched a speak up policy last year, and or you know, we brought on a speak up process to use outside companies to take in claims. But it isn't, I'm trying to tell people, speak up isn't just about whistleblowing. That's just a fancy way of saying it, you know, without saying whistleblowing, it's speak up. Because the idea for me of speak up is speak up with your great ideas, come with concerns, not necessarily compliance or ethics concerns, but it's, you know, this line is running at this speed, but if we did these tweaks, we might speed it up. You know, I want to speak up about everything, because then you'll be comfortable speaking up about when you see things that are issues. And as a compliance officer, it's only that small little bit that really affects my life. But I want to build that entire thing into the system of our ecosystem as a company, so that we get all the businesses get the benefit of it as well.
And why is it so hard, you think, for organizations to get both sides of the same coin we're talking about? Hey, I want you to speak up about the bad stuff, but also what goes along with that, to your point, a true three-dimensional speak up culture is you're speaking up about the good and the bad. And I think that's rooted down in this ownership thing. But why don't people get it?
I think there's a huge mindset issue.
Yeah.
You know, people, you know, the sort of leadership have been doing it for many years. And particularly when you feel you're being a successful company, it's really harder then to then go, oh, hold on. We are successful, but you're saying there's issues. I'm not saying there's issues. I'm saying we can do better. But hold on, we're successful. We're doing everything right. No, I'm not saying we're doing anything bad. I'm just saying we want to improve, because we need to keep developing. We don't want to get stagnated. And it's the fixed mindset of, if it's not broken, don't tinker with it. Whereas I think the more modern ethics and compliance person is saying, we need to keep moving. Just like everything else in the company you want to develop, You're developing your technology a little bit. You may be moving in small steps, which is fine, but you're moving forward. The same with ethics and compliance. And I think the fixed mindset is, oh, it's not broken, so I'm not going to mess about with it. And they don't.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the interesting part is that whatever you define as success, quote unquote success, it's not a leading indicator. It's a lagging indicator. It's the result of some stuff that has happened. So just because you're quote unquote successful now, whatever that means, that doesn't mean that today's environment or the current circumstances are going to allow those next 100 years to look like the last 100 years. And I think it's an important point because everything changes, everything grows, all these dynamics change. Yeah. And I'd love for you to kind of speak into this generational shift that's happening. And like, why is this stuff now getting attention when 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't?
Yeah. I think, I'm even just reflecting on, I was born in 77. I was going to primary school in the 80s, secondary school in the 90s and university in the 90s and came out and it was get a good job. And I think it wasn't too much different from the sort of boomer generation as well. Get a good job, work hard. It was almost be a yes man. In fact, I remember when I was in private practice, your job, Kevin, is to make my job easy and to make me look good. That's your job. It wasn't develop ideas, think, come to me with great ideas, give me some advice. No, your job is to make me look good. And I think that was the mindset actually in a lot of law firms at the time. And so it was, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work hard, keep my head down, don't put my head above the parapet if I can avoid it. But when I think it's strategically right, do that and I'll get ahead. And actually, to be fair, I've done all right out of that. But then you get to the point is, hold on, I'm not speaking up. Why is that? I've got these ideas, and now I'm in a leadership position. Isn't that what leaders do?
Right.
Is help develop these ideas and get buy-in for it and help your team develop their ideas as well, because their ideas may be better than mine. That's what great leadership is, I think, is finding you bouncing it off everybody. I'm not the smartest guy in the room, I don't know everything and I'm okay with that. That's why I have a great team of people to help me.
To help make you look good, yeah.
Yeah, whereas I think this new generation of leaders and workforce are of a different mindset. And actually, I'm close enough to them that I feel like I would rather be them. And it always got me. I was like, I don't get why people disparage millennials. It's like, it's so hard to work with millennials, blah, blah, blah. They're so needy, they so want. But the question is, did they affect your productivity? When did they come into the workforce? Oh, let's see. Oh, great financial crisis in the sort of last 10, 15 years and just before that. So what was happening? Well, they were part of that boom period of the late 2000s and then the move towards a more digital entrepreneurial society. So actually, what's negative about that? There's nothing. Yeah, nothing's perfect because they're all starting out. They're learning, but they're happy to make their mistakes and learn from them. And I think that's actually a really positive thing. And, all of these books on leadership, learn from your mistakes, all of these great entrepreneurs, it's all right to make a mistake because you learn. Even, what was it, Edison. I didn't have 10,000 failures. I just had 10,000 different ideas. It was along those lines.
Something he said was like, yeah, I love when I figure out one that doesn't work because now that's one step closer to that will work. I mean, 10,000 is a massive number, by the way. It's crazy. And, so I think you kind of nailed it. And it's baffling to me that there's this pushback against this. Look, it's a tidal wave of millennials that are crashing into the workforce. It's the demographics of it, right? Like that pig is moving through the snake. In 10 years, they're going to be 75% of it. So I think it behooves a lot of leaders to just say, oh, they're just tough to work with. They're always texting. Well, why do they act the way that they act? They're not a different species. They're just born 10 years later than you or 5 years later or 20 years, whatever it is. And I think you really nailed what that millennial experience is. And I think those things that millennials saw as they were coming up shattered a lot of those tenets of success that you talked about you know, work hard, get a good job, be a yes man, make me look good. Like those sort of like last century type of, you know, tips for success. Yeah. I think they've seen, to your point, that, you know, those don't really hold a lot of water when housing is crashing or the stock market's crashing or I have 200,000 of student loan debt and there's no jobs.
Yeah. And look at the people who were leading the companies that were in, you know, that was a different generation. That is still, I guess, the current generation who are leaders at that level. They're the same people who, you know, this younger generation saw what they did with their businesses and were affected. You know, they may, their fathers or mothers may not have been the leaders. They may have been the workers who was made redundant.
You got it.
You know, couldn't put food on the table, struggled. And so I think also they didn't see their parents. Their parents were off working, you know. It was, and they've seen it. They want a different life. And actually they want something which works. And, you know, I think that with COVID as well, the whole work from home, I don't think you can argue with them now.
Right.
You're not hearing about companies going bust because people were working from home.
Right.
In fact, I'm hearing about more companies feeling that they're more productive. And I've heard about companies that are like, yeah, only 20% of our workforce are coming back by the end of this year. And it's really because they more so they may want to. I'm sure, pretty sure who that generation of people want to go back in are.
Yeah. There's a lot in what you just said. So I think this thing has forced a lot of change, right? The COVID has forced a ton of change and forced us to sort of, you know, use technology in ways that may have otherwise taken 10 years. So that's a big deal. And it's just kind of interesting where some of these things that were off the table, like, absolutely, we don't have a distributed workforce. If you work here, you need to be here. I want to make sure, right? To your point, it's not like all these companies are going under because people are working from home and the TV has a soap opera on during the day. It doesn't seem to be happening. Yeah. And it's a real eye opener for me in particular, because I'm somebody who I think, you know, I probably would have said, yeah, we're probably a lot more productive if we're in the office, but you know, all that commute time's gone, all that sort of chit chat time is gone. People, and you know, people on my team are still getting a ton of stuff done. So it's been an interesting shift, and it's allowed, you know, it's kind of forced this remote work thing to be kind of put to the test. And I think largely, at least from folks I'm talking to, it's kind of working.
Yeah. And I feel like personally, I found time and energy. You know, I was exercising and I haven't stopped that. So it can't be to do with that. And I think it is when you go into an office, you put your game face on.
Right.
So that take that much zap energy. I live in Michigan, so there is no public transport. So I drive. It's not that far. I mean, it's between 20 minutes and 40 minutes, sometimes an hour, depending on traffic. But, you know, isn't that long. But that expends a lot of energy, which I'm not thinking about work because I've got to concentrate on the road. And you're doing that two ways. And that's all gone. But now I'm so energized every morning. I feel excited about the day, getting cracking. And actually, you know, you heard the word flow where you just zone out. Mm-hmm. And usually I do something at the end of the day. I always put a task that I feel excited about doing, but I leave it towards the end of the day, which is a good thing and a bad thing because I get sometimes so absorbed in it. It's like, oh, it is like 6 or 7 and I need to go and my son is about to go to bed or something like that. Or more recently I've had to say, right, today, 4 o'clock, bang on, that's it. Finished or not of the tasks I want to do. And I guess that's the pleasure of sort of this sort of role is you're ultimately setting your own tasks. You're not always driven by some other sort of deadline or deliverable. So it's the work that you want to do. So I'm today, 4 o'clock, bang, I'm going to go and play in a paddling pool with my son. And that's good. But it's, this is really, I feel so energized. So I'm really excited about each day and working because I feel like I've got the energy and it's not a drain. And yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, to some extent, like the spaces that we're in influence our behaviors. And not only has this COVID thing helped us to kind of humanize each other a little bit more, right? Because we're all humans, regardless of whether we're meeting in a work environment or we're meeting at a park or whatever. I think because of all those old things, those old structures and those old mentalities, there was almost like a dehumanization within the four walls of most organizations where this is my coworker. This isn't even a person. I just need this report from this person. Right. But now everyone's kind of going through this thing together. People are working from home. So not only can they be more authentic, but these Zoom meetings, while I know some people hate them, you don't even have to wear pants to them. I'm kidding. But like it forces you to kind of engage at it and be more present, right? Like, you know, I know we're in different places, different parts of the country, but we each have a camera on us and we're looking at each other and we're totally here and I'm not distracted by my phone. And so that's a positive. And it's been interesting over the last couple of months to see this transition from this was the worst thing that ever happened to now more and more people are like you who can see some of the benefit of it, right? You don't have this commute you have to do all the time. You can be in your own place. You can be more focused or any of these other externalities that were hard to identify as soon as this thing kicked off and the world was ending. They're now opportunities for us to kind of elevate and, you know, multiply our impact. And I just don't think a lot of people saw that, you know, a month and a half ago or something.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Nick. I think we've had a real transformation, you know, even in face-to-face meetings that I've attended over the years, you know, you get in them and sometimes, and I found this more prevalent in the US, I've got to say, and maybe it's a culture thing here, is you overstack meetings with people who don't necessarily need to be in. And it's almost like, oh yeah, you should listen into this. Well, if I'm not contributing, is it worthwhile? Right. So then, you know, in these meetings, you get people on their phones. So they're not even engaged. You're in the same room, physically close enough to each other.
Right.
You're not engaged. Whereas actually the Zoom meetings, whether it's on phone or with video as well, I tend to find they're much more productive. They kept much more within the time limits. You're not going off. Right. You're still having those sort of, hello, how you doing sort of conversations, but you're also much more zoned in and focused. And yeah, with the videos, you can't be sat there on your phone, you know, even if it's like even bigger groups. I've always seen on these, I've done so many of them over the last 3 months. It's incredible. But yeah, you're much more engaged.
It's just a weird thing. It's a weird, we're at a weird time, but there's like so much opportunity in this time. I was talking to somebody else and they said that, you know, over the last, you know, since the start of the year, we as like a society have gone through like 7 to 10 years of change. Like, you know, without this thing, it would have taken 7 to 10 years for us to be as distributed of a workforce as we are now and using technology to kind of interact to the extent we are now. And this pulling forward of these new behaviors is creating a lot of positive externalities, which you just kind of talked about, but it's creating a lot of other opportunities for us to kind of elevate and readjust to this new world we're living in, you know?
Yeah. And I was like, I was in Trader Joe's, which is like, I consider that my happy space as well. It's one of the happiest places in the world, I find. Yeah. I was chatting with the checkout lady and, she was like talking about it. And I was like, and I'd been thinking while I was in the queue, you know, they're doing a social distancing one in, one out type thing. I'd been thinking, you know, when I was looking to hire someone before, it was always a consideration, you know, they have to be, you've got to come to the office, you know, you've got an office here, you've got to be in. And not that personally, I expected that person to be in every day, but that was their base.
Yeah. Yeah.
So geographically, the talent pool that I was looking at was much smaller. Because ultimately, that's their base. And there is an expectation that even if it's not for me, that other people, other colleagues, you need to be coming in for meetings, blah, blah, blah. Now I've just realized my talent pool can be anywhere in the world as long as they can make meetings when we sort of need them on relatively short notice. It's pretty much acceptable that my talent pool has grown. You know, and then I'm thinking about things like diversity and inclusion. Where you could go with that as how that could really exponentially, the talent pool isn't there. Sure. Because right. if this role is not based in an office and doesn't need to be based in an office or a work site, then your talent pool is pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, there's like no excuse for lack of diversity. Yeah. Kind of pretty, you know, if there even whatever was one, it's going to go away pretty quick to your point, because a lot of these geographical issues are kind of eliminated in this new thing that we've all kind of proven out, you know?
Yeah, and I was thinking about when I was in Asia, when I was based there, I was in Shanghai, And I was looking at moving to Hong Kong, but I was going to bring a lawyer in to Shanghai. And I interviewed a ton of lawyers. All good, but not quite right fit for what I was looking for. And I remember speaking, and I think it was a lot to do with the English language and being able to communicate, because the role was going to be a senior role and they needed to be able to have that level of English that, not just about communicating with me.
The nuance and all that. Yeah.
So then, I remember speaking to this recruiter and he said, well, you know, not to be funny, it's going to cost you more money, but you're going to get the type of lawyer you want in Hong Kong. So I ended up just having the role in Hong Kong, which was then away from the China management team. And it worked, you know, and there was a lot of travel and stuff. But now it's like, you know what? I probably wouldn't, that wouldn't even be a consideration now. As long as I can find a lawyer anywhere that can speak Mandarin and do the job, and the travel is going to be the same. It doesn't really matter where they are.
It's been a game changer to make those employee adoptions, because you now, the whole world is your oyster, you know?
Yeah.
So as we're kind of getting toward the end here, I'd like to kind of circle back to, you know, strategies or like advice you would give to ethics and compliance folks who are in organizations that maybe don't get the stuff we're talking about. They see it as a kind of a check the box function. What do you think the things are that those folks can do to elevate and help turn those lights on at the top? Or if you can't turn them on, how do you kind of solve the problem the other way? How do you avoid falling into the fixed mentality that can come along with living in a freaking pigeonhole or a cost center, you know, box?
Yeah, I think you've got to build relationships outside of just the traditional relationships of the legal department, predominantly internal audit. You've got to be focusing on HR I think you need to work away at the top level. But sometimes if you're not getting the traction there, work away at the level below, because they tend to get it and they tend to be the ones held responsible anyway. So work with them, developing plans to communicate the issues of the why. Why is it important? That is so key. Why is this important? And give examples of other companies, you know, look outside the box. Don't look just in your sector or your type of company. Look at what are other companies doing that are really good ideas. And you know what? I think ethics and compliance is one of the most sharing communities out there. You know, if it's good practice, we want it, because ultimately we want all companies to be doing similar things to drive that engagement and not have the kind of issues that we have seen.
Right. That's an important point. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, that's a really important point, because it's almost like the clarity of purpose within ethics and compliance is still pure. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Sales organizations are not trading tips with the competition. You know what I'm saying? But like, that's not there, because there's a different sort of purity of purpose in these functions, because we're trying to make the world better. We're trying to make our workplaces better. And if you can make your workplace better, great. That's what I'm after as well, you know?
Yeah. And it's not about, I think the other tip is go and talk to people. Don't just send emails, pick up the phone, have those conversations with random people in your organization. It's almost like testing the pulse, getting their sense of what's happening, what's their issues, where do they see issues, you know? And you can do these big engagement surveys or the, you know, risk and compliance surveys, which are great, but then you need to, you know, it's not just doing them, it's delivering, but it's sometimes easier. I don't always think they show you the true underlying sense, because if there's fear, then people don't trust, you know. And we had an app to do an engagement survey, and we still had people saying, I'm not sure this is 100% anonymous. And, right. You know,
it's like, how can I get you comfortable with this?
And that's because they don't trust the leadership.
Correct.
So we've got to work on things like that. And so it's like, if you're seeing those issues, then go and talk to the managers and say, look, I want to work with you on delivering a course on building trust, you know, for you and your team. And then hopefully they can start working it down into their teams. And and let's not expect a quick fix. We're going to be in it. We're going to be in it for the long run. And it's about trying to get those small wins. And I think that's what you've got to work towards. You can, having setting these big lofty goals is, it's not impossible. You will get there, but you're only going to get there by the small wins. So let people know that they're getting small wins. And if you advertise the small wins all the time and set the goals that they're achievable, You hit that, people get uplifted by, yeah, this is actually working. So they'll move to the next one. You keep doing it. And eventually you'll get to your end goal.
Yeah. And you, if I guess to your point, if you can speed up the frequency or increase the frequency of the feedback loop and celebrate those wins, it's going to just get more people who are kind of on the edge saying, you know, should I jump in this pool or not? Is this real or not? It's going to get them to make that commitment. And then that starts to turn into a self-reinforcing mechanism. And then you're going to start really accelerating up that sort of culture curve or that trust curve or the purpose curve, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's work on defining the purpose of the company and talk about it. And in your, you know, communications, refer back to your core values. If you value those, refer back to them, keep reinforcing those messages, because you want to, you know, you're not going to get everybody on board at once, but people will come on board when they see successes. And you've got to go back to the heart, and the heart and soul of a company is the core values and the vision and mission.
Well, Kevin, this has been a great conversation, man. You are a pioneer, whether you know it or not. You are you're like an explorer. You're like, you are the archetype for what the compliance function is going to be in the next 10 years. So I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate you, your willingness to be a thought leader and step out there and to, you know, make your world a better place, through your workforce. And I don't know, this is great, man. Your insights are so, I don't know, they're so concentrated because you're kind of living it and you're climbing this mountain yourself, and yet you see the opportunity that's there. And I just commend you for not falling into that sort of fixed mentality that thinks, well, I can't change this stuff, because all this stuff can be changed. It takes effort. It takes concerted effort, and you have to do the right things, but all this stuff is malleable. All this stuff can be altered and shifted toward what we want it to be, you know?
Yeah. And thank you for having me on. And, you know, I'll probably add that the only constant in life is change.
Right. How can people find you, Kevin? How can they get in touch with you if they want to pick your brain some more?
Email kevin.withane@gmail.com. LinkedIn is Kevin Withane. And you can find me on Twitter at Kevin Withane.
Cool. Very good. All right. Well, we'll post that again, man. Thanks for coming on. This was a lot of fun. Hope you have a great rest of your week. And I hope I get to see that soul glow in that hair.
I'm not sure.
Just think about it. Sleep.
My wife is going to entertain my wife, and that's the most important thing.
That's the most important. Have a great day, bud.
Cheers, Nick. Thanks.